Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Anlu Kieva. Today, we're going to be talking about some of the response to the DA's new BEE procurement policy. We're also going to be talking a little bit about a ruling by the public protector with regards to the Amapanyaza. And we're going to be speaking about grey listing in South Africa. So let's start off with the first one. There are arguments pushing back on the things we say about BEE. There are people who claim that BEE has contributed to creating a black middle class, that it's breaking down barriers of systemic racism, things like that. Now, we don't agree with a lot of those defenses of BEE, but those are, shall we say, more reasonable. That is not the argument being made by the Black Business Council, which is a lobby group that represents a number of businesses and professionals, which has attacked the DA's proposed alternative to BEE, calling it a continuation of apartheid. The CEO, Mr. Matabane, said that the bill dismally fails to deal with the historical imbalances of the past and lived reality of more than 92% of the population. This is a quote from the CEO of the Black Business Council. In the eyes of the DA, black people are only good as recipients of social grants or handouts, but not worthy to own any part of their own economy. In our view, the DA desperately wishes South Africa could go back to the bad days of apartheid, where black people were exploited as servants of white power with no power or say. He said that because of BEE, we now have black executives, chairmen, and CEOs of both public and private sector companies, primarily due to employment equity. Would not have been allowed as members of the DA without employment equity. They are now practicing what we call kick the ladder. Unfortunately, this is the level that so much of the rhetoric on this is at. And I must say, Anlu, you know, I'm just endlessly frustrated by the continuing refusal of defenders of BEE to actually defend BEE on its record of other than, well, now we've got some black CEOs. I mean, firstly, the implication is that that never would have happened without BEE, which I think is ridiculous. And secondly, what about the 42% of South Africans, most of whom are black, are living in unemployment, and the, what, more than 50% who are living in poverty? It's just so frustrating. Your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, something that I've once again realized these past couple of weeks, especially watching both the commissions that we have going on at the moment, is that this again feels like one of those situations where it's just the usual theater of South African politics, where any, particularly in this situation, where any reform proposal that dares move away from race-based policy gets painted exactly into that same old apartheid thing, where either you have to do what we recommend or you want apartheid back. So without obviously commenting on whether the use of the SDGs as the DA proposes is a good idea or not, I think the DA's bill is about changing how the state does their procurement and not about deciding who's allowed to participate in the economy. And the idea, at least as they frame it, is that the shift should be away from the racial targets. So what's odd, though, and you mentioned this, is how they just present it, how BBC or the Black Business Council presents it. They claim that the bill means that only white people will be able to continue, or business will only continue to be done with big white companies. And that's quite the leap. Like, there's no evidence in the text of the bill that suggests anything even remotely close to that. It's more a reflection of how BEE actually becomes a political, like, identity marker almost, rather than actually having to or wanting to promote development and policy that helps the South African economy grow and create jobs. And then there's this specific line that he said, in the eyes of the DA, black people are only good as recipients of social benefits or handouts, and that they're not worthy to participate in the economy on their own. And okay, so I'm not going to use my 5 minutes that I have here to promote the DA's bill at all. If anyone's interested, they can obviously read it for themselves. But the problem I have with this statement is that there's a massive blind spot in this argument. The argument he's making is the same argument that the people who say BEE is working or not working is making. And that's the case that, why say these people need a ladder? Why are you constantly reinforcing this idea that black people won't be able to achieve it on their own? are you saying that they are not strong enough to have this, or clever enough, or smart enough, or talented enough to have this, create a life for themselves? Why do you constantly want to give them a ladder to step up on? All these companies who boast about their BEE scores. I mean, without the obligation, are you saying that you would not have hired Black people? Is that what you are saying? Because that's the actual problem then. I think maybe the deeper issue here is just that we've built a system entirely around the assumption that people can't succeed without being helped. And we see this across the South African economy. And that's the part that it doesn't sit right with me. If you believe people are capable, then why create a framework that constantly tells them that they aren't, that they're not capable? And I think if you don't fix that, we don't need to fix inequality by lowering the bar. We need to fix the economy by getting it to grow, and that will actually create more opportunities. And you don't need, at the end of the day, race as a criteria to get people involved in the economy.
Even if you believe the sort of cartoonish characterization that white people and white business owners are so racist that they just will refuse to do business with any Black-owned companies, or refuse to do business with Black employees, or promote Black South Africans into positions in management. Any company that did that, I mean, firstly, the degree to which those are the only people run the economy is massively exaggerated. But the second part is, any company that behaved that racistly would be destroying its own ability to succeed in the business place. You know, that would be saying, 80% of the population is potential. We're going to cut them out as potential employees and customers and, business partners and that kind of thing. It would just be complete suicide. I mean, maybe in 1960s South Africa, that's a far more realistic version of what would happen. But today, in 2025, that's just not true. And there is a Black middle class now that is larger already than the white middle class. And it is not because of BEE, but it is because people seized on the opportunities that the abolishment of apartheid created. People invested in their children's education. People took the skills that they did have and they used them to create businesses, to get jobs for themselves, to uplift themselves. Those people are not going away. Those people are part of the country's economic fabric. And, it's like speaking in these sort of generalities, as these arguments made by the Black Business Council sort of seem to do, are just very frustrating, because they're just not dealing with the reality, which is that BEE has failed the vast majority of Black South Africans. Very nice. You're a CEO and you've benefited from some huge BEE deal. Very happy for you. What about the vast majority of South Africans who have been helped not one bit by these policies?
Yeah, and I think it just shows how stuck the conversation around empowerment really is. I think the Black Business Council in this instance treat the challenge to BEE as an attack on Black advancement, and that's really not what it is. It's just about not using race as a category to get involved in the economy. And I 100% agree with you. If these businesses were that racist, they would probably not survive, especially not nowadays.
Very frustrating stuff. But obviously, we continue to make the arguments about how BEE has not succeeded, because factually speaking, it has not succeeded. And I'm once again reiterate that while one can find problems with any policy put out by a political party, in this case the DA's alternative to BEE, it's definitely a massive step in the right direction towards actually improving the economic conditions of the majority of South Africans. And I think that's a good thing. We're having more of that in our public discourse. Okay. Let's move on to our next story. This is based on a report from the Public Protector. The Public Protector has found that the so-called Amapanyaza, who are the official name for them is the Crime Prevention Wardens. This is a program started by the Gauteng provincial government, and they are named after Panyaza Lesufi, as an attempt to sort of firstly create employment opportunities, and secondly fight crime across Gauteng. The program has been criticized by a lot of people who say that the Amapanyaza are often poorly trained, There's been accusations of sort of this is just a political patronage network, that this has done very little to actually reduce crime, and that Panyaza Lesufi has been massively overplaying his hand in how much power these crime prevention wardens actually have. Well, the public protector has found that establishing and deploying these crime prevention wardens to conduct policing was irregular, unlawful, and inconsistent with the Constitution. The public protector's investigation found that the department, the Gauteng Department of Community Safety's conduct in establishing, recruiting, appointing, and deploying wardens was without a supporting legal framework. It was unlawful and a breach of the Constitution. The public protector criticized the action, saying, quote, the department's conduct was inconsistent with section 41(1)(f) and (g) of the Constitution that states that all spheres of government and all organs of state within each sphere must not assume any power or function except those conferred on them in terms of the Constitution, and must exercise their powers and perform their functions in a manner that does not encroach on the geographical, functional, or institutional integrity of government in another sphere. The law neither empowers nor confers upon the provincial government any authority to exercise policing powers. Any conduct that seeks to assume any power or function not granted by law, or to perform functions or powers that fall exclusively within another sphere of government, shall be unlawful and unconstitutional. The public protector stated that the complainant's allegation that the functionaries of the Gauteng Department of Community Safety was substantiated and has enacted some remedial actions. Lesufi must within 180 days ensure that the crime prevention wardens operate as traffic wardens under the National Road Traffic Act in line with the agreement involving the justice and police ministers. The Gauteng MEC for Community Safety must regularize their appointment as traffic wardens within 180 days. The head of the Gauteng Department of Community Safety must improve staff training within 60 days to enhance legal and operational competency. Police and justice ministers must support lawful retention of the crime prevention wardens as traffic wardens, and the National Commissioner and Road Traffic Management Corporation must ensure they meet training and legal requirements. So a lot of stuff there, but let me just firstly say, seems like there's suddenly going to be quite a few too many traffic wardens, which is a good thing, because you know, cutting roads are a bit chaotic. My second thought, though, is that while I think there were big problems with the crime prevention wardens program, I think that they go counter to some of the solutions that we need to actually turn around policing in this country, which is we need to decentralize policing powers. It seems here like the public protector's report kind of is very strongly defending the principle that devolving powers to provincial governments is not in line with the Constitution. Not a lawyer, so I'm trading on dangerous territory here, but Anlu, what's your thoughts on all of this?
You, in the pre-show, when you mentioned that perhaps this might have some legal implications down the line, you had me a little bit conflicted. Well, at least I am a little bit conflicted now. But my initial thoughts, at least, was that I kind of laughed it off. Laughed at it, because it felt a little bit predictable after months of questions about what exactly Amaponyaza was doing or were doing. The public protector essentially just confirmed what many suspected.
Just to remind people, there was a point where Panyaza Lesufi had a public fight, I think, with Becky Fele, because Panyaza Lesufi wanted to arm the crime prevention wardens, which, yeah, considering their reputation, doesn't seem like a great thing.
And I saw a couple ads that just said, you need no experience, you just come be agile. They're looking for young, agile people who are willing to work shifts, which sounds exactly like the type of person I want to put a weapon in the hands of. I kind of was happy to hear at least that it was declared illegal. I'm not so happy about the fact that it feels like he didn't really take accountability. He's now redeploying them somewhere else, as traffic wardens, but it's still on the taxpayer's bill. And I mean, it feels like there's no accountability, even in the sense just of saying, listen, you know what, sorry, we spent lots of money on these people and now they did nothing, they got money, but now they just being redeployed, going into training for 6 months. And the real tragedy for me is that Gauteng's crime problems are very serious. And people are very desperate for safety. And so instead of actually fixing the police and improving SAPs and hiring more detectives, which we know is something that we desperately need, we wasted time and money on something that turned out to be a glorified election gimmick, because remember that it happened just before the elections. We shouldn't forget that. So yeah, we know some of the other efforts that almost came with this full package was digital surveillance. And there's as many question marks around that, not only about the actual surveillance, but also just the efficiency of it. If we look at trust in law, if we look at the efficiency of law enforcement, we again and again see that trust in law enforcement is one of the most important aspects of efficiency. And we know that other than just the technology itself being outdated, if you are not able to actually, it doesn't help you have footage of somebody stealing something, but you can't actually catch the people. If there's no connection or follow through, then what's the use of having a camera catch these people? And that's perhaps one of the most important lessons that we learn here, is that we need trust reestablished in our enforcement agencies. And something like Amar Binyaza really did not enforce that trust. We see that in surveys, like 3 out of 5 people say that they have no trust in the South African police. I mean, who do you call now if you have an emergency? Definitely not, I don't know, 10111 doesn't even work anymore. But anyway, and then something that stood out to me is just the disciplinary hearings in the police force. So as a bit of a historic context, in 2015-16, there was around 5,000 disciplinary hearings. And in the last 6 years, they struggled to get more than 1,000. And then for like 2022-23, they had only 64 of the police officers that were part of hearings were found guilty, and 32 were fired. This is exactly why we have a trust problem with our law enforcement. It's because of the discipline within the agencies that is just absent. And I mean, it took us months and much more money than we even paid these officers to come to the single conclusion that this is illegal. I mean, how much longer is it going to take us to actually reinforce the discipline within these agencies? But then, of course, I have to mention, and I do agree with your point here, is that the bad part about scrapping the unit is that it shuts down what could have been a very useful test, at least, I suppose, and a case for decentralizing the police force. Gauteng's wardens were a mess, but it's partly because how they were set up, and they were no proper legal framework, of course. But, I mean, giving provinces some control over policing isn't crazy. There's lots of good arguments for having to decentralize it, tailoring police service in the province to the needs of the province. There's very strong arguments for it. And now that it's been ruled unconstitutional, can make future attempts to have provincial policing much harder. And it essentially killed the experiment, which is a loss. So we'll see how it goes in the future if the argument needs to be made.
I've heard opponents of the Western Cape government's LEAP program use similar arguments to attack the LEAP program there, which has proven to be, I think, so far, at least from my understanding of it, a more successful version of kind of trying to increase a province's role in policing. I suspect that this ruling will be used as a stick to rhetorically beat that program. I'm not sure how legally sound that is. I'd have to read a legal analysis actually to see, you know, what the major differences were. And I suspect, as you say, you know, the legal framework and those technical details are very likely to be quite significantly different. But at least in the political arena, I can see this being used to further the argument that, now LEAP must also be shut down and we can't have anything else like this ever again. Just because this particular version, I think, was an example of how not to do decentralizing of the police, which is an important reminder that, you know, many of the policies that we promote, I think, can still be done badly if you don't, focus on the important things like professionalism, training, that kind of stuff. Okay.
And can I just say something else?
Go
And
ahead, go ahead.
hiring the right people for these positions, it doesn't help if we hire desperate police officers. We need people who actually want to be a police officer to be in these positions. It makes us almost the essence of the role.
Yeah, you know, I'm not a fan of sort of make work programs and government employment schemes in general, but I can think one of the worst places to do something like that to employ people just for the sake of employment is in law enforcement, where you need like a sort of kind of ethos and commitment to the role to do it truly excellently. And you know, just finding desperate people with no experience who just need a paycheck to fill that position does not seem like a great recipe
Yeah. And I
for
mean, they
success.
paid these officers 4,000 rand a month, like stipend during training, which that's not a lot of money. And for you to be willing to, I know unemployment's obviously vast, like people are desperate for work, but for you to be willing to work for 4,000 rand really does not inspire me to believe that you will carry the essence of civil servant.
Yeah, no, it's a difficult thing. But
Anyway.
anyway, let's move on to our last story. In 2023, South Africa made bad headlines around the world when we were ruled by the Financial Action Task Force, which is the sort of intergovernmental organization that sort of sets standards and tries to push back on illegal financial crimes, on financial crimes and terrorist funding around the world. And they found that South Africa was not doing so hot on combating money laundering and terrorist financing and that kind of thing. So we were added to the so-called grey list after this watchdog said that we were not upholding good standards when it came to tackling financial issues. Now, this is a bit of a problem, increases the regulatory burden on foreign companies or South Africans sort of trying to do financial transactions across borders. And it was also a really bad sign for investors. So since this happened in 2023, South Africa has been desperately trying to get off the grey list. There is a worse level than the grey list called the blacklist, which is apparently South Africa has never been on, thank goodness. But you know, even being on the grey list was bad enough for us. Parliament passed various pieces of legislation, and there's been a lot of activity from government to try and get things back on track. And there were 22 action items that the Financial Action Task Force suggested that South Africa needed to comply with in order to get itself removed from the grey list. And a bunch of financial analysts reported in the media are suggesting that it's pretty likely that at the meeting of this group, which is going on at the moment and will release its information on Friday, that being tomorrow, that South Africa is probably going to get taken off the grey list. Now, I know the government has done some work on this to get us in the right position, but you know, as we're seeing right now from the commissions being held into our police force, the entire sort of law enforcement apparatus of South Africa has been revealed to be even shakier, I think, than anyone outside perhaps thought it might be. I don't know, Anlu, you know, what's your take on this? I mean, you were saying before the show that ultimately getting off the grey list is just convincing a committee that we need to get off the playlist, off the grey list. But what's your take on this one?
Yeah, headline take is that we know it's incredibly important to get off this list for investor confidence. It would sincerely help. We know that being on the list affects our access to international financial markets, and we need capital in the country. We have particularly low reinvestment rates in the country. We have particularly low cross-fixed capital formation investments. And if we actually want to see any long-term commitments to the country, we need investor confidence to go up. But yeah, some analysts say we will come off. Some say we won't come off. I told you in the beginning I will not be reading tea leaves. I have not been trained in that. I don't know how to. But yeah, I mean, what essentially happened up until here is that we've ticked 20 of the 22 boxes that they gave us. And now the two boxes that's essentially left is to actually prosecute some of the people, which kind of like that's the whole point, isn't it? It's like getting full marks on your homework and then the part where you were actually supposed to catch the criminals, you just didn't do that part. So the last step is the one that actually matters. And yet kind of seems like they're hoping that it doesn't matter as much. So we've been here before, and we continue to be in this exact same position with all the commissions that we've set up. I mean, even if you take the commissions that we have now, some of the stuff that's coming out, like, we've heard this when we had the Zondo Commission. And still, like, how many people has actually taken accountability for that? But anyway, so the state just has these endless frameworks and endless strategies and endless investigations. And then it comes to the same point of where we get to real convictions. It's just going at glacial speed. It is slow, and we will do it, and it will be done. So yeah, to be honest, we don't have a very good record of prosecuting corruption. And that's why we landed on the grey list in the first place. I particularly liked what Kevin Ling said, who is the chief economist at StanLib. And you made this point as well now, where he said that these corruption allegations that are coming out now can potentially derail this process. And I don't know if that's been accounted for, if analysts say that we will come off the list. There are some very serious allegations that are coming out in these commissions that we see now. And we need to keep in mind that police corruption is exactly the type of thing that the Financial Action Task Force flagged as not being adequately addressed when they first placed us on the grey list. And are we expecting them to ignore these latest findings? So yeah, we'll see what happens. I'm not going to read tea leaves, but I think the point that you made, and this is something that Chris Hutton, who's the executive director of the Center for Risk Analysis, you're obviously a colleague of ours, is that kind of, okay, we've now technically satisfied the task force's technical demands, but we shouldn't frame this as a comeback story. Getting off this list doesn't mean that we've cleaned up. It just means that we've convinced somehow this global committee that we are trying to. And that really is not the comeback story that we are hoping for.
Right. You know, it's definitely a good thing, but it's also not even close to the beginning of enough. I think that's the sort of underlying message here. All right. Well, thank you very much, everyone, for listening. Tomorrow at 1:30, we will have the live show as per usual. I hope you all have a wonderful day, and we'll see you tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a great one. The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.